content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the July 7th and July 14th issue of the Week. So we have one of those weeks where we've got one magazine for 2 weeks. The staff of the week's taking a break. And we'll cover the material over 2 weeks and get into a little deeper in the issue. But we'll start, as usual, with the cover drawing. This week it shows a kitchen scene. There is a huge pot on a gas stove. It's turned up high. You can see the water is boiling and coming over it a little bit. In the pot, we see Russian President Vladimir Putin. He is beet red. There's sweat dripping down his forehead. He's got a rather concerned look on his face. In the background, in a chef's outfit, is Yevgeny Prigozhin. He's got his hand up with a OK symbol, and he's got kind of a smug look on his face looking at Putin in the pot. The headline is, "Revenge is Served. Has Putin's chef finally weakened Russia's czar?" And that's our first main story, but I'll start today reading the editor's letter. It has been a disappointing decade for democracy. The fall of the Iron Curtain is receding into the past. Instead, in places like the Arab world that were supposed to be turning the corner, we have seen an authoritarian revival. In Russia and China, any tilt toward democracy has been reversed. Hong Kong stands as a searing example of how freedoms can be taken away. Established democracies have taken a turn toward cults of personality. Each of these, Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, Narendra Modi in India, and yes, Donald Trump in the United States, comes with its own flavor. But they all share a basic disregard for minority rights and institutional safeguards. Modi in particular has risen with a brand of explicitly xenophobic and violent Hindu nationalism. Yet last week, the United States hosted Modi in lavish style. At home, autocrats are cracking down. Abroad, they are showing off and playing their strong hands. The unfortunate truth is that increasingly the United States is being forced to choose between evils. There are the evils that are known, Vladimir Putin, and those that are substantially unknown, like Yevgeny Prigozhin. There are the adversaries we need to keep in check, like China's Xi Jinping, and there are the autocrats whose goodwill we need to cultivate. Worst of all, the autocrats know this and have become skilled in triangulating between the U.S., China, and Russia and pulling the levers, oil, refugees, that make the West swallow hard and put moral conviction on the back burner. There is no easy solution here. But in the long run, advancing democracy and safeguarding human rights are our own brand of realpolitik. Our values are also our interests. The only world that is safe for the United States is one in which democracy is ascendant. Whatever compromises we make along the way, that remains the goal. That was from Mark Gimine, the managing editor. And the first main story, as referred to with the cover drawing, Prigozhin's aborted coup leaves Putin weakened. What happened? Russian mercenary leader Yevgeny Prigozhin landed in Belarus this week, 3 days after he spearheaded and then called off a rebellion that had posed an unprecedented challenge to President Vladimir Putin's 23-year rule. The stunning revolt came after months of lacerating criticism of Russian military leaders by Prigozhin, a longtime ally of the Russian dictator whose 25,000 Wagner Group fighters have been a key fighting force in Ukraine. It came a week before a deadline for its fighters to sign contracts with the Russian army and Wagner to be dissolved, an order he'd vowed to resist. After Prigozhin claimed 30 of his soldiers had been killed by Russian missile strikes, unopposed Wagner fighters took control of the southern city of Rostov-on-Don, a major staging base for the Ukraine invasion, where they were cheered by some residents. They then advanced toward Moscow. There they would finish with this mess, Prigozhin said, while Putin vowed to crush the mutiny. As Prigozhin's forces got within 125 miles of the capital, he abruptly turned them around, and the Kremlin announced that Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko had brokered a deal allowing Prigozhin to evade criminal charges and go into exile in Belarus. Lukashenko said he'd warned Prigozhin he'd be crushed like a bug if his advance continued, perhaps by attacks from the air. And the Telegraph reported that Putin had threatened to kill his family members. Prigozhin said the march was not a coup attempt, but a protest against corrupt and incompetent military leaders, such as Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, who were bent on Wagner's destruction. A visibly angry Putin denounced the rebellion without naming Prigozhin. They wanted Russians to fight each other, he said. Attempts to create internal unrest are doomed to failure. President Biden stayed silent during the uprising, saying later that he'd wanted to offer Putin no excuse to blame it on the West. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, "We've seen some various serious cracks emerge. I doubt we've seen the final act." What the editorial said. Like Dr. Frankenstein, Putin created a monster he ultimately couldn't control, said the Chicago Tribune. Prigozhin is a former convict who began his rise to power running a restaurant and catering company to which Putin steered lucrative contracts, earning him the moniker Putin Chef. He made more than $1 billion through Putin's patronage and then built a mercenary fighting force that did Putin's dirty work in Syria, Africa, and now Ukraine. But now he's gone from minion to mutineer and dealt a severe blow to Putin's image of invincibility. Simply put, Prigozhin threatened and Putin blinked. This marks a turning point in Putin's 23-year rule, said the Washington Post. His humiliation by Prigozhin presents new risks and dangers for Russia, Ukraine, and the world. To restore his strongman image, Putin may attempt a show of force, punishing critics and steering Russia even more toward totalitarianism. The West's need to prepare for unpredictability and instability from Russia just got even stronger. What the columnist said. Prigozhin has shifted the ground in Russia by voicing a dirty little secret, said David A. Andelman in CNN.com. In withering statements watched by millions, he challenged Putin's pretext for invading Ukraine, saying the war was a racket staged by a corrupt elite using Russian soldiers as cannon fodder. Now Russian citizens and soldiers alike may more than ever be wondering just why they are fighting Putin's war. Prigozhin is a dead man walking, said James Risen in The Intercept. He had a golden opportunity to seize power from a surprised and vulnerable Putin, but lost his nerve. Now he's in the crosshairs of a dictator who's killed many for far less, and it's folly to think Putin's stooge, Lukashenko, will protect him for long. But Putin, too, is also a dead man walking, now that his tenuous hold on power has been exposed to the world. That might be wishful thinking, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. Putin clearly suffered a blow, but Joseph Stalin only tightened his grip on dictatorship through one factional fight after another, and the wily Putin could likewise launch a palace purge and embark on an even more intense phase of totalitarian rule. Putin's demise may not be imminent, said Gabrielle Gavin in Politico, but the groundwork for another coup has been laid. Not long ago, it was impossible to imagine a Russia without the iron-fisted Vladimir the Invincible, who, whatever his faults, was trusted to provide security and stability. But the aborted rebellion by his former caterer offered a premonition of what the war could lead to: chaos and defeat. More forebodingly for Moscow's strongman, it gave Russians and the world a glimpse of how, when the time is right, he might run out of luck. And we'll read the second main story. Supreme Court nixes radical election theory. What happened? The Supreme Court this week rejected a fringe legal doctrine that threatened to shatter the system of checks and balances governing U.S. elections. In Moore v. Harper, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett sided with the court's three liberals to find that North Carolina's state Supreme Court acted within its authority in throwing out a heavily gerrymandered electoral map. The map favored Republicans in 10 out of 14 districts in a state with slightly more registered Democrats than Republicans. In Moore, North Carolina Republicans invoked the independent state legislature theory, which argues that the Elections Clause of the Constitution gives state legislatures sole control over federal elections. The theory's most extreme form holds that no other state body, not the courts, nor the governor, nor the election commission, can alter whatever voting rules the legislature chooses to set. Writing for the majority, Roberts rejected that argument, saying the Constitution does not insulate state legislatures from the ordinary exercise of state judicial review. But he added the caveat that courts do not have free rein over election law. The decision's impact in North Carolina will be minimal because the state Supreme Court has since flipped from Democratic to Republican control and reversed its ruling. The state legislature may now draw a new map that skews Republican. Justice Clarence Thomas and two other dissenters argued that this should have rendered the case moot. Moore was one of the most closely watched U.S. Supreme Court cases this term. The court typically wraps up in late June, but as the week went to press, it still hadn't released decisions on hot-button issues such as affirmative action, LGBTQ rights, religious liberty, and President Biden's $400 billion student loan program. What the editorial said. Whew, said the Washington Post. The independent state legislature theory's absurdly expansive interpretation of the Elections Clause, which grants state lawmakers the power to determine the times, places, and manner of elections, posed a serious threat to democracy. The majority was right to ignore the claim of mootness and seize the chance to denounce the theory as ahistoric, in clear conflict with precedent, and essentially baloney. Many questions remain unanswered, said the Wall Street Journal. Roberts' opinion warned state courts that transgressing the ordinary bounds of judicial review would be unacceptable, but it declined to specify what those bounds are. As the dissenters point out, such vagueness will encourage federal deference to state court decisions. In election years, partisans often challenge state ballot laws, and state courts often intervene at the last minute, as in 2020 when the Pennsylvania court literally rewrote state election law to extend the deadline for receiving mail-in ballots. This ruling will incentivize more of that kind of elections mischief. What the columnist said. Had the court upheld the doctrine, it would have been doomsday for fair elections, said Andy Craig in the Daily Beast. Recall that after the 2020 election, Trump supporters invoked the independent state legislature theory to urge Republican-controlled legislatures in states Joe Biden won to replace Biden's electors with Trump-backing ones. It didn't work then, but with the court's blessing, the 2024 election could have been stolen. Instead, America's experiment in self-government lives another day. This should put to rest the conspiracy theory that the Roberts Court is controlled by a conservative cabal that seeks to impose one-party rule, said Jonathan Turley in The Hill. For months, hysterical leftists have been making dire predictions that the Moore ruling would destroy democracy. In reality, of course, the court's conservatives proved to be independent legal thinkers, not ideological robots or dark money cutouts. And Roberts is once again in the driver's seat, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. The Dobbs ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade last year suggested that the court's arch-conservative flamethrowers had wrested control from the moderate Chief Justice. This term, though, featured multiple cases where Republicans mounted sloppy, big-swing arguments that coalitions of conservatives and liberal justices shot down in the interest of upholding precedent. The Roberts Court thus gets to look reasonable, moderate, and independent simply by virtue of leaving laws in place. With decisions such as Moore, it sure looks like a majority of the justices want us to know that they are backing away from the brink. Our controversy of the week. Alito, another member of the Billionaires Boys Club. The entitlement, the hubris, the tone deafness, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. On the heels of recent revelations about Clarence Thomas' decades of unreported largesse from Republican megadonor Harlan Crow, ProPublica revealed last week that Justice Samuel Alito also has a right-wing billionaire sugar daddy with interest before the Supreme Court. In 2008, Alito accepted an all-expenses-paid luxury fishing expedition to Alaska, where he stayed at a $1,000-a-night fishing lodge, feasted on Kobe beef and king crab legs, and washed down with $1,000-a-bottle wine, all paid for by billionaire conservative activist Robin Arkley. Alito flew to Alaska on the private jet of Paul Singer, another GOP megadonor, whose business later netted $2.4 billion when Alito and the Supreme Court sided with him in a financial dispute. The private flight alone was valued at $100,000, but in a peevish op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Alito argued that lavish trip would not cause a reasonable and unbiased person to doubt his impartiality. Alito's defense is a string of absurd pseudo-legalistic evasions, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. Like Thomas, he claims the gifts all constituted personal hospitality from a friend, which judges Neaton report, but also that he barely knows Singer and had no inkling he had business before the court. Most laughable of all is Alito's contention that if he hadn't flown on Singer's jet, his seat would have otherwise been vacant, presumably meaning the trip had no real value. Are we really doing this again, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. As we explained during the Thomas non-scandal, judicial guidelines were changed only this year to exclude private jet trips from personal hospitality and to require they be reported, meaning Alito violated no rules in 2008. As for Singer's court case, it was decided 7-1, making Alito's involvement irrelevant. The ProPublica smear is not about ethics. It's about the left's fury at having lost control of the court and its desperate attempt to delegitimize its rulings and force justices to recuse themselves. The Alito story, like the Thomas story before it, said Noah Rothman in National Review, is a campaign of intimidation masquerading as journalism. ever since he arrived on the court 17 years ago, said Jesse Wegman in the New York Times. Alito has been a bare-knuckled partisan soldier, not a neutral arbiter of the law. This is the same justice who mouthed "not true" during President Obama's State of the Union speech, who overturned Roe with such sneering disdain for women, and who reliably rules for the fossil fuels industry, despite his family's own substantial holdings in natural gas. No wonder public trust in the court is in free fall. If there is an evergreen presence in these stories, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times, it's Leonard Leo. The Federalist Society leader not only was instrumental in creating and picking the court's conservative supermajority, but also organized Alito's trip with Singer, helped foster Thomas' friendship with Crow, and maintains this creepy billionaire buddies program to wrap favored justices in a web of personal and emotional bonds. There's a reason Thomas and Alito did not report their benefactors' largesse, said Dahlia Lithwick and Slate. Deep down, they know these magnificent vacations are an influence scheme being run by Leo, Singer, Crow, et al., who know exactly what they're doing and what they're getting for their hospitality. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It's a good week for job openings, with the news that an anonymous U.S. billionaire, a couple living in Britain, is looking to hire a full-time live-in dog nanny at a starting salary of $127,227. The job listing says the successful applicant will combine superlative dog pampering skills with the ability to handle sensitive information with the utmost discretion and confidentiality. It was a good week for face mask companies. After more smoke from 488 still active Canadian wildfires caused air quality alerts in 20 states from Minnesota down to Georgia. And it was a good week for diagnoses after former Republican Liz Cheney said the problem with current U.S. politics is that we're electing idiots. Cheney suggested that voters should try electing serious people. It's a bad week for Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who called fellow right-winger Representative Lauren Boebert a little bitch on the House floor. Days later, Greene announced that the TV in her Washington, D.C. residence turned on by itself, with someone trying to connect to the TV. It was a bad week for master classes after Jacob Chansley, the self-styled QAnon shaman of the January 6th insurrection, was released from prison and began offering hour-long coaching sessions in topics such as astrology, spirituality, and politics for $500. Finally, it was a bad week for graffiti after an unidentified tourist was captured on cell phone video carving the message Ivan plus Haley, 23, into a wall of the 1,951-year-old Colosseum in Rome. Italian authorities are searching for the vandal, who faces $16,000 in fines and 5 years in prison. It's a short and other news piece. Report casts doubt on COVID lab leak theory. U.S. spy agencies found no evidence that the SARS-CoV-2 virus leaked from a lab in Wuhan, China, where COVID was first detected in humans in 2019, according to a government intelligence report declassified last week. The Wuhan Institute of Virology did research coronaviruses and had faulty safety precautions, the report said, but none of the viruses studied there could plausibly be a progenitor of the COVID virus, the report found. Three lab workers fell mildly ill in November 2019, but the report said their systems were consistent with colds or allergies and blood samples came back negative for COVID. Five U.S. intelligence agencies favor the animal spillover hypothesis, while two agencies lean toward a lab leak. We'll work through a number of the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance short pieces this week. I've got three from the U.S. at a glance, starting with Texas. Sweltering. Temperatures rose as high as 115 degrees in Texas as a lingering heat dome caused triple-digit readings day after day through the south and southeast. In Austin, where the heat index, a combination of heat and humidity, hit 118 degrees last week, paramedics have responded to more than 100 heat-related incidents over the past 2 weeks, and hundreds more were reported across the state. At least two hikers died from heat exhaustion, and Dallas officials are investigating whether heat caused the death of a 66-year-old postal carrier, Eugene Gates Jr., who collapsed in a resident's front yard. With air conditioning usage stretching demand on Texas power grid to record peaks, cities opened cooling stations in public buildings. The 115-degree peak was reached in Del Rio, Texas, which saw 10 straight days of record highs. Brutal temperatures were also seen in Florida, Oklahoma, Louisiana, New Mexico, and other places, putting one-third of Americans under heat advisories. Washington, D.C., executive power. States can't force the federal government to arrest and detain more immigrants who enter the country illegally, the Supreme Court ruled last week in a major victory for the Biden administration. In an 8-1 decision, the justices said Texas and Louisiana lack standing to sue the Biden administration over its policy of only detaining illegal immigrants while their cases move forward if they pose threats to national security, public safety, and border security. The ruling overturned a Texas-based judge's decision. Writing for the majority, Justice Brett Kavanaugh said letting states sue over federal law enforcement could produce a flood of lawsuits challenging alleged under-enforcement of drug and gun laws. Conservative Justice Samuel Alito dissented, writing that selective enforcement of immigration law radically alters the balance of power between Congress and the executive. Orlando, drag on. A federal judge last week temporarily blocked a Florida law that threatens to suspend or revoke the licenses of businesses that let kids attend drag shows, saying such a ban likely violates First Amendment speech rights. Although the GOP-backed legislation, which went into effect last month, is framed as applying to adult live performances, Judge Gregory Purnell said it is unconstitutionally vague and is specifically designed to suppress the speech of drag queen performers. The bill's sponsor, Republican Randy Fine, had said that it will protect our children by ending the gateway propaganda to this evil drag queen story time. Hamburger Mary's, an Orlando restaurant that regularly hosts drag performances, had sued Florida, saying it lost customers after barring children from drag shows. Recently, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis told a conservative Christian group that drag shows are not necessarily my cup of tea, adding, "We believe in letting kids be kids." And on to the world at a glance. This comes from Ottawa. Stop dumping cruise waste. Canada last week banned ships from dumping sewage near its shores. Cruise ships traveling back and forth to Alaska, most of them American, release some 8.5 billion gallons of waste a year into the ocean off Canada's west coast. The toxic stew includes sewage from toilets, gray water from showers and washing machines, oily bilge water pumped out of ships' hulls, and chemical waste from scrubbers that filter exhaust gases. U.S. law has long limited or banned dumping off Washington and Alaska, but Canada's laws were looser. The new rules prohibit the discharge of untreated sewage within 12 miles of the coast. Environmental activist Anna Barford said the old policies created a perverse incentive to treat Canada like a toilet bowl. This is from Sokoto, Nigeria. Mob stones man to death. A mob killed a man in Nigeria's northwest Sokoto state this week after he was accused of blasphemy against Islam. Usman Buda, a butcher, was said to have blasphemed the Prophet Muhammad while arguing with another trader in a slaughterhouse. Video shared by witnesses showed a crowd, including children, pelting Buddha with stones and cursing him until he lay unconscious. Sokoto Governor Ahmed Aliyu said that citizens shouldn't take the law into their own hands, but he also suggested blasphemy was the bigger problem. Sokoto people have so much respect and regard for Prophet Muhammad, his spokesperson said, hence the need for all residents to respect and protect his dignity. Much of northern Nigeria is governed under Sharia law. Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Biggest Hajj ever. Huge crowds of people braved 113-degree temperatures in Mecca this week to perform the symbolic stoning of the devil as part of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. A record 2.5 million Muslims participated this year, as people who delayed the trip during the pandemic turned out in mass. White-clad pilgrims sheltered from the sun under umbrellas, their cell phones too hot to hold. Saudi authorities stationed tens of thousands of health workers around the holy site, such as the Kaaba, the cube structure pilgrims must circle seven times at the start and end of the five-day event. All Muslims are expected to make the Hajj at least once in their lives, if they are able. Pyongyang, anti-U.S. rallies. North Korea this week said the U.S. was making desperate efforts to ignite a nuclear war by conducting joint military exercises with South Korea and transferring weapons to Seoul. In a long report published in state media, the regime of dictator Kim Jong-un warned that any military conflict would cause a thermonuclear war unprecedented in the world. The missive followed a mass anti-U.S. rally over the weekend, with tens of thousands of North Koreans marching in tight choreography to mark the 73rd anniversary of the start of the Korean War. May Day Stadium in Pyongyang was jammed with people, some holding signs reading, "The whole U.S. is within our shooting range," and others chanting slogans like, "Annihilate the U.S. imperialists." North Korea has had nuclear weapons since the early 2000s and has recently tested numerous missiles capable of delivering them. Seoul. Everyone gets younger. South Koreans all turned 1 year younger this week after the country changed the way it calculates age to fall in line with the rest of the world. Under the traditional Korean system, children were considered a year old at birth, effectively counting their time in utero, and 1 year was added not on their birthdays, but every January 1st. That meant a baby born in December would be labeled 2 years old the next month. President Yoon Suk-yeol had campaigned on abolishing the old system, saying it created unnecessary social and economic costs and had led to legal disputes over eligibility for government benefits. Polls showed South Koreans overwhelmingly supported using the international standard. moving into some of the best columns. We'll start with the value of partnering with Modi. The U.S. and India are on the verge of forming a true alliance, said Noah Smith. A very friendly meeting between President Biden and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi last week yielded a startlingly broad multi-billion dollar bundle of cooperative military and economic agreements. A small group of progressive House Democrats boycotted Modi's speech, citing the Hindu nationalist persecution of Muslims and suppression of free speech. Modi has indeed taken India in a troubling direction, but that does not justify shunning an alliance with the world's most populous country. We've partnered with worst leaders, including Joseph Stalin, to defeat greater global evils. India can serve as a powerful U.S. regional ally in our great power competition with Xi Jinping's China, which is a techno-totalitarian surveillance state and aggressive regional bully. India can serve as a massive new market for U.S. products and a more secure place for manufacturers to move. So let's avoid high-handed moralism and treat India as we did other allies such as Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan when they went through illiberal periods. It made sense to believe in those countries during their darker days. I think we should believe in India now. Trump's pardon paradox. Donald Trump has it all wrong, said Jennifer Rubin. The former president seems to think he can avoid federal prison time by winning the 2024 election and then pardoning himself for any federal felony convictions. But his only hope for getting a get-out-of-jail card is that a different Republican wins the nomination and becomes president. Trump and his supporters are talking about self-pardons, but there is no legal basis in the Constitution for something so illogical, and they would not stand up to even this Supreme Court's review. If self-pardons were possible, then why would not every president take advantage of the opportunity to engage in a crime spree, secure in the knowledge he could pardon himself on the way out the door? Not incidentally, presidential pardons only apply to federal crimes. And Trump is facing state charges in New York and may soon be charged with trying to overturn election results in Georgia, a serious crime. To avoid potential incarceration, Trump will need either to make plea deals with prosecutors and or get a pardon promise from a Republican rival in return for Trump's endorsement. The last thing he should want is to win the presidency. Here's a piece called Viewpoint from Rich Lowry in National Review. Revolutions, attempted rebellions, assassination, and coups dot the Russian historical landscape. This isn't unusual in old nations. What makes Russia different is that it is dealing with them to this day. A couple millennia after Athens and a couple hundred years after the modern democratic revolution, Russia still has a de facto czar. Whereas we read about poisonings in history books telling the story of medieval Europe, they still happen in Russia. If he's going to maintain his sense of dominance, Vladimir Putin isn't ultimately going to defeat Yevgeny Prigozhin in an election or simply fire or reprimand him. He's going to have to kill him. A related piece, this column coming from Europe. Ukraine, what Prigozhin's uprising means for the war. Vladimir Putin's strongman image has collapsed with a bang, said Maxim Trudolyubov in Medusa. Though last week's attempted coup by militia commander Yevgeny Prigozhin fizzled out in less than 24 hours, the armed uprising by his Wagner Group mercenaries demonstrated the vulnerability at the core of Putin's system of power. It isn't just that Prigozhin humiliated the army by managing to seize Rostov-on-Don, a Russian city of millions and a command center for the Ukraine war, without firing a single shot. It's that his rebellion showed that Putin is unable to control his own flunkies. Ostensibly an independent militia, Wagner was actually a Kremlin-funded force that did Putin's dirty work in Africa and the Middle East, and Prigozhin was Putin's man. But over the past few months, Prigozhin was able to reinvent himself as a populist opposition figure, putting out videos railing against the elite generals he accused of botching the war and gaining a great deal of personal popularity. He may have failed to topple Putin, but he badly damaged him. "This rebellion played out in plain sight," said Strana in an unsigned article. Prigozhin was in open revolt for months, trashing the military in profanity-laden tirades and refusing a direct order to place his Wagner fighters under defense ministry control. He even mused about marching on Moscow in an interview with an influential Russian war blogger at the end of April. Yet even as it became obvious he was leading up to a riot, Russian authorities continued to pump him with weapons, money, and PR in horse doses. Was it because of some internal struggle in the Kremlin or just incompetence? And why was Prigozhin allowed to retreat with many of his men to Belarus instead of being shot as a traitor? Some Ukrainians were alarmed by that development, said Maria Boyko in TSN.ua. If Wagner were to regroup in neighboring Belarus, the force would have a straight shot at Kyiv. But the generals say there's no real threat, noting that Kyiv's defenses already foiled a 40,000-strong Russian attack last year. Analyst Alexander Kovalenko says Putin may be sending Prigozhin on a suicide mission. If someone in the Kremlin decided to get rid of a group of rebels, he said, the best option is to order them to capture Kyiv. Even if Prigozhin is killed, in battle or by assassination, the coup he set in motion is not over, said Sergei Taran in Ukrainska Pravda. Consider, right before Prigozhin launched his putsch, he made the shocking assertion that Ukraine had not, in fact, been shelling the Donbas region for years, as Putin claimed in launching the war. Such a statement couldn't be aimed at Putin, who hates being contradicted, or at the Russian public, which doesn't care about Ukrainians. The intended audience has to have been Ukraine and the West, a signal that Prigozhin and those who stand behind him are ready to give Putin up. Prigozhin may be in Belarus, but his backers are still in the Kremlin. The next act in this drama could well be Putin's curtain call. This is an international How They See Us piece about Biden and Modi's visit. Biden fets India's repressive leader. Welcome to the Indian American century, said Namrata Brar in NDTV from India. Last week, the Biden administration launched a charm offensive like never before to welcome Prime Minister Narendra Modi to Washington. After literally rolling out the red carpet, the White House served the vegetarian Hindu leader and some 400 other guests a plant-based state dinner, a feast of stuffed mushrooms with saffron risotto. Biden later took the love fest to Twitter, declaring that the friendship between the United States and India is among the most consequential in the world. And why shouldn't it be? India has more to offer the United States than other permanent friends like the United Kingdom and Israel. As the most populous country in the world, we have what the U.S. needs most, a buyer for its products. And we're ramping up production of the semiconductors and the other hardware the U.S. depends on. Those realms, commerce and tech, dominated the many agreements Biden and Modi signed. That means America can't simply toss us aside when the geopolitical headwinds blow in a different direction. And it's done to erstwhile allies like Venezuela and Pakistan. Thanks to Modi's visit, the U.S. and India are in a real marriage with contracts. It's a marriage built on mutual distrust of China, said Khushbu Razdan in the South China Morning Post from China. After years of silence on Chinese claims to sovereignty over the South China Sea, where Beijing has been militarizing tiny atolls and buzzing other countries' ships, India has finally made a tilt toward Washington. Modi now agrees with Biden that India should be a bulwark against soaring Chinese power in Asia. But India is playing a dangerous game. Unlike the U.S., India is already in direct conflict with China along the two countries' mutual 2,000-mile border. Skirmishes there are frequent, and one such incident in 2020 killed 20 Indian and 4 Chinese soldiers. By cozying up to the U.S. on defense, India risks violence on its doorstep. In his zeal for an India alliance against China, Biden chose to overlook Modi's dangerous bigotry, said Dawn from Pakistan in an editorial. 2 decades ago, when Modi was governor of Gujarat, he was actually banned from entering the U.S. for stoking a Hindu riot that killed more than 1,000 Muslims. And he hasn't changed. Ever since Modi took power in 2014, his Bharatiya Janata Party has unleashed a vicious brand of Hindu nationalism that demonizes India's 200 million strong Muslim minority. BJP leaders have led anti-Muslim rallies, calling Muslims vermin and exhorting crowds of Hindus to wipe them out. Riots and lynchings have proliferated, and Modi won't even condemn them. At this point, India's very democracy is at stake, said Tavleen Singh in the Financial Express from India. Modi has used colonial-era sedition laws to criminalize all dissent, and not just from Muslims. He has allowed Hindu nationalists to take over major media and to threaten and abuse journalists, and he has locked up protesters. Countries where political opponents are crushed by the repressive organs of the state are autocracies, not democracies. On the Talking Points page, we'll start with a article titled A Year Without Roe, How America Has Changed. Dreams dashed, intentions scuttled, childhoods abruptly ended, talents and potential suppressed, health risked, said Maura Donegan in The Guardian. The year that has passed since the Supreme Court's conservative majority overturned Roe in its Dobbs ruling has ended a half century in which women were full citizens, endowed with dignity to determine their own family futures and sexual lives. Deprived of bodily autonomy, young girls have had to bear their rapist children, and women with failing pregnancies have endured sepsis and other life-threatening emergencies because risk-averse doctors feared being prosecuted for providing necessary care. The ruling was surely one of the most disruptive Supreme Court decisions in generations, said Amelia Thompson DeVoe in 538. A quarter of American women of reproductive age who live in Republican-run states are now subject to total or near-total bans. An estimated 93,575 fewer legal abortions occurred in states with bans in the 9 months after Dobbs, but 69,285 more abortions occurred in states where it remains legal, suggesting that many people traveled from red states. An unknown number secretly took abortion pills. The political backlash was enormous, with a big pro-choice swing. Recent polls reveal a record 69% of Americans supporting first trimester abortion and 53% in favor of legalized abortion in all or most cases. After a big Republican disappointment in the 2022 midterms, a 6-6 pro-choice victories on state referenda, abortion has become a huge liability for the GOP. Yet Republican lawmakers can't stop digging at their self-inflicted wounds, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Dobbs was ostensibly supposed to leave the issue of abortion up to the states. And 80% of Americans, including 65% of Republicans and 83% of independents, oppose a national abortion ban. But anti-abortion groups have attacked lawmakers who've stopped short of their maximalist goals. So a national ban is on the table. Republican presidential candidates seem reluctant to talk about the issue, said Sally Goldenberg in Politico. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis makes little mention of the six-week ban he signed in April, while chief rival Donald Trump attacks such laws as too harsh. Only former Vice President Mike Pence openly embraces a hardline anti-abortion position, demanding all Republican candidates embrace a 15-week ban as a minimum nationwide standard. Anyone who values human life should celebrate Dobbs' anniversary, said National Review in an editorial. Much still needs to be done, as many of the laws passed in 23 states to protect the lives of unborn children at 6 weeks of pregnancy have been held up in court. And the number of abortions has dropped only 3.5% since April 2022. Still, each life saved is priceless. To make further progress, pro-lifers need to have tactical flexibility, said Ramesh Paniro in the Washington Post. The political obstacles to pro-life political ambitions are real. And in the 2022 midterms, too many Republican candidates embraced no-exceptions abortion bans and lost. Polls show that most Americans still favor restrictions after the first trimester. That's why it was smart for Republicans in North Carolina and Nebraska to recently pass bans after 12 weeks. It's also important that all health and life of mother exceptions should be clearly worded so that doctors feel free to treat pregnancy complications properly. Those exceptions are fictions designed to make anti-abortion laws more politically palatable, said Sarah Green Carmichael in Bloomberg. In the post-Dobbs reality, fearful doctors are denying care to women with troubled pregnancies or miscarriages until they're severely ill. A Louisiana woman could not get an abortion even though her fetus had no skull. A Florida hospital sent a woman away after her water broke at 16 weeks, leaving her to miscarry in a hair salon and lose half the blood in her body. Other women have been forced to get hysterectomies or lost their fallopian tubes because of an unconscionable delays in treatment. Supporters of abortion access need a game plan for overturning Dobbs, said David S. Cohen in the New York Times. After Roe was decided in 1973, anti-abortion activists launched a multifaceted long-term strategy to overturn what it saw as an egregiously wrong decision, chipping away at abortion rights in the courts and state legislatures. Likewise, pro-choice lawyers need to bring case after case attacking Dobbs from every legal angle possible. Democrats must make overturning Dobbs a central part of their party platform and confirm judges who believe in reproductive rights. All this could take decades to yield results, but the current Supreme Court majority won't last forever. If ever there was a time for hope and for a strategy directly targeting Dobbs, this is it. We're down to some of the short notes on the Talking Points page. Half of Americans have faced an extreme weather alert since the start of May for threats that include wildfires, flooding, tropical storms, and extreme heat. 50% is a very troubling sort of threshold that we've crossed, said Juan Declet Barreto of the Union of Concerned Scientists, which says tens of millions of Americans will face such warnings this summer. The median age in the U.S. reached an all-time high of 38.9 in 2022, up from 35 in 2000 and 30 in 1980. The rise is mainly attributable to declining birth rates, while reduced immigration and the continued aging of baby boomers is also play a role. U.S. pedestrian deaths have reached a 40-year high. Motorists killed more than 7,500 pedestrians last year, estimates the Governor's Highway Safety Association, which attributes the increase in part to the popularity of trucks and SUVs, which are heavier and bigger and more likely to kill pedestrians. Same-sex couples account for about 1% of U.S. households, a 30% increase since the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage nationwide 8 years ago. Wyoming and Utah saw their number of same-sex households roughly double between 2015 and 2021. And we'll finish up with, we'll get two quotes this week. Biographer Ian Penman, quoted in the London Review of Books, says, "The problem with making art to wake people up is that your ideal reader-viewer is asleep." And Miles Davis, quoted in the New Hampshire Journal, says, "It's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't play." Hope you all had a good July 4th week. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.